If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast. Fascinating historical conversations from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Revealed. Paris has long been a popular destination among Russian elites. But in 1917, the Russian Revolution saw unprecedented scores of aristocrats and artists flee to the city. Speaking to Matt Elton, Helen Rappaport charts some of their stories, the dramatic shift in circumstances that many endured, and what the city's inhabitants made of the new arrivals.
Helen, your fascinating new book, After the Romanovs, tells a kind of a group biography of some people who were dislocated by the currents of world history and whose lives tell us something about the time in which they lived. To start with, I wondered if you could just sort of give a nutshell, a brief overview of what it is, the period your book explores and what it sets out to do, I suppose.
Well, when I originally conceived the book, I was going to take it pretty much from when there was an absolute mass exodus of the intelligentsia, the professional classes, and the remnants of the aristocracy after the revolution. So fundamentally, I was going to take the book from when the White Army counter-revolution failed, and the remnants of that army were forced south by the Red Army, followed by a huge number, thousands and thousands of civilians, families and sympathisers of the whites who followed them south down through Ukraine. It's all very, there's some rather tragic echoes here, to Crimea, to get on boats and get out of Russia. The only way really they could get out at the time was south via the Black Sea and across to Constantinople. But in order to really point up the tragic change in circumstance that many of these people suffered, and many of them had had comfortable lives in Russia before the revolution, you know, they'd been professionals, lawyers, doctors, university professors, journalists, writers, plus the aristocrats, of course. In order to really show the dramatic change in their lives, I decided to start the book, in fact, at the end of the Belle Epoque, in Marcel Proust Paris, when at that time many, many wealthy Russians were regularly touring and flying to Paris. It was their favourite watering hole. And, you know, they were shopping at Worth and Cartier and dining at the Ritz and swanning around, spending prodigious amounts of money. Plus, in that period, the 1900s, before World War One, before my story kicks off, there was an incredible influx of creative Russian talent into Paris. Artists, sculptors, but primarily and predominantly the Ballet Russe, Diaghilev's Ballet Russe. And I wanted to show this incredibly vibrant émigré scene that the Russians had already created in that city, because it had always been a favourite place for Russians to go. I wanted to create a sense of contrast between that and what happened later, where, you know, suddenly all these wealthy aristocrats return to Paris after the revolution, when they, on that massive exodus out of Russia at the end of 1919 and in 1920, they come back in greatly reduced circumstances. And you see people dramatically impoverished, homeless, rootless, impoverished. And really, I wanted to take it from there to examine this very profound sense of the loss of the homeland and the motherland that many of them lived with for the rest of their lives, and they never really adjusted because of that.
And the book really evocatively, I think, charts that contrast. To head back to the sort of the beginnings of this story, what was it specifically about Paris that meant that people from Russia were so drawn to it during the period your book starts?
Well, of course, Paris was freer for a start. In Tsarist Russia, there was fairly strict censorship and controls over what you could and couldn't write and publish. Paris had always been very attractive to Russians, pretty much from the end of the Crimean War onwards. Certainly, people like the writer Turgenev settled there in, I think, the 1850s and lived in Paris. But where it really kicked off was in the 1860s with the first big exposition. I think it was 1868 that they held, after all the hostilities of the Crimean War, when Russia and France, of course, had been on opposing sides. There was this burst of interest in Paris by wealthy Russians from the 1860s, and it became a hugely popular watering hole, as I've said, for the aristocracy, who also, of course, patronised the resorts of particularly Cannes and Nice, and also in Brittany and places like that. So there was already quite a considerable influx of wealthy Russians into Paris in the final four decades of the 19th century. Many of them even had apartments and homes in Paris. For example, some of the Russian Grand Dukes, like Grand Duke Paul, bought a beautiful house in the Bois de Boulogne. Grand Duke Alexis had a flat in Paris and, in fact, became almost permanently a Paris resident. And Grand Duke Vladimir came back and forth, and with them came their wives and their jewels and their glamour. And, you know, if you wanted to see and be seen and go to any posh parties in Paris, you were sure to bump into a Grand Duke or a prince or a count or someone Russian. And they even feature a couple of them briefly in Marcel Proust's À la recherche du temps perdu.
I wanted to get a sense of what the atmosphere would have been like in Paris during this earlier period. How extravagant and how lavish were some of these lifestyles you talk about in the book?
Oh, incredibly extravagant. So many of the Grand Dukes and their wives came to Paris and were hanging out in all the top restaurants and swanky casinos and places, that there was this thing called La Tournée des Grands Ducs, the Grand Duke's Tour, which was a tour of the high-class, sort of slightly dubious nightclubs and sort of high-class brothels and gambling dens and various other places in Paris that all these Grand Dukes frequented. And there are quite a few anecdotes of them spending lavish amounts of money, you know, on high-class courtesans and wining and dining and thinking, you know, thinking the money was never going to stop coming, which is why it's such a pointed contrast. When you see someone like, for example, he's one of the main characters in my book, Grand Duke Dmitry Pavlovich, who one of the gay young blades, one of the younger members of the Romanov family, swanning around Paris in this enormous car, wining and dining women and giving them, you know, presents of Cartier jewels and sending them boxes of orchids and cigarettes as gifts. And you see him swanning around Paris in the years before the war and then arriving after, of course, the debacle of being involved in the murder of Rasputin. He arrived back in Paris in about 1921, completely broke. And really, what's so extraordinary about a lot of these ex-aristocrats like Dmitri is sort of he dined out on his celebrity, you know, so he would still be seen in the Ritz and all the posh places that he'd hung out in before, as so long as somebody else was picking up the tab. And he very quickly found himself a very wealthy patron in the shape of Coco Chanel, who was just coming into her celebrity and had established a very successful fashion atelier in Paris. And for a while, he had an affair with her and swanned around with her. She actually, in fact, had already moved on from Stravinsky. She talked about the Russian men all being terribly sad, pathetic creatures. And the thing that kept them from the void of despair was drinking, basically. And she, in a way, encapsulate this terrible melancholy of a lot of the displaced Russians, particularly the aristocracy in Paris, who are down on their uppers. And of course, it was in a way the women who were far more enterprising than the displaced men at creating an income for themselves, because a lot of the Russian women, the aristocratic women, went into the fashion trade, or if they were not working as sempstresses and fashion and setting up fashion houses, a lot of the Russian women were favoured as models, as mannequins by the French fashion houses.
As some of the names you've just mentioned there, Stravinsky, Chanel, suggest, this is a book that's packed with huge figures in their own right. Some of them are less familiar, certainly they were for me. How difficult was it to choose who to follow, and how did you go about doing that?
Well, I had a very clear idea of how I needed to write the book. I had to try and find representative figures for each of the various kind of groups of people who went to Paris. So obviously you've got your aristocrats, you've got your writers and journalists, your poets, your artists, the dancers, the white Russian ex-army who'd all flooded in. And of course, under the surface, quite a lot of political intriguers and spies and all sorts of people. The only real problem with the book is, in terms of documentation, obviously, quite a lot of the aristocracy are documented or wrote memoirs or wrote letters. And similarly, the writers and journalists, people like Ivan Bunin was a major figure of the emigration in Paris. And one of my key figures in the book. But finding the stories of ordinary Russians who fled, the kind of people who'd had quite good jobs in Tsarist Russia, but who now were literally, you know, waiting tables, washing windows, driving taxis, or, as a huge number ended up doing, working on the assembly lines at the big Renault factory at Billancourt. Finding accounts of those lives was much harder because many of them just didn't really write about it. Their lives were a grind of staying solvent, keeping a roof over their heads, just earning enough to survive. It was more the writers who talked about, you know, how awful it was trying to kind of earn a living from doing small piecework for the very low circulation Russian emigre papers and magazines. This was a huge step down for them after having, you know, been big figures in Russia, as Bunin was. He'd been a great celebrity, a great figure in Russian literature. In Paris, you know, even he constantly complained about trying to make a living. So in terms of representing all the different groups of people who ended up in Paris, I tried very, very hard to find people who were less well known, but who had interesting stories and who really suffered and struggled, because it would have been very easy to cop out and just write about all the displaced aristocrats. So I didn't want to write just about them. So I made a real effort to find people, and it took a lot of searching. And you can only find most of these people searching in primary Russian sources. You're not going to find them, or French sources. There are one or two French sources on the Russian emigres in Paris, but they're not particularly, well, none of them are very good at all about the poor people who went, who really struggled. I really had to work very hard to get context on the thousands of Russians living out at Billancourt, which was where the Renault and Citroën factories were, the ones who worked on the assembly lines, where they had a whole Russian little village there with Russian shops, Russian church, Russian hairdressers, everything, you know, everything was Russian. They spoke Russian and they lived in a little Russian microcosm there. And that particularly interested me, that community.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
I have friends in Russia, you know, intellectual friends, artistic, creative people, and they have told me that exactly the same kind of people are leaving, have left after the war broke out, that left in around 1919-20.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda. Whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch, find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches, but there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Briefly zoom out a bit in this story. We've mentioned that there's a pivot that happens in this book between what happened before and what happened after. Yeah. For people who might be coming to this subject completely cold, who don't know anything about this subject, can you, in the sort of broadest possible terms, set out what was happening in Russia that led to this change in circumstances?
Well, the Russian Revolution had broken in 1917. And from that, there were two revolutions. One, the popular revolt and the big protest marches in February on the Russian calendar, and then the Bolshevik coup at the end of the year in October. But from the moment the revolution broke, people started leaving, particularly people who were antipathetic to the new regime, particularly people opposed, people... landed gentry and people like that who had somewhere they could go to, like bolt holes in Paris, and quite a few did, or homes elsewhere. But the real push came with the Bolshevik takeover in the autumn of 1918, because it was then made clear by Lenin and the Bolsheviks that, you know, the Romanovs in particular were public enemy number one. All the old aristocracy were, you know, they were going to be hounded down and chased out or murdered, and many were. Quite a lot of the Romanovs were killed without even being able to get out of Russia, as people will know, because I've written three other books about the Romanov family and their murder in Ekaterinburg. But there are also other members of the family murdered. But as time went on, and then the civil war broke out in Russia at the end of 1918, over the next couple of years, you get a counter-revolution growing between various opposition groups, including monarchists, ex-aristocracy, all kinds of people. They weren't necessarily wanting to put the Tsar back on the throne. They just were vehemently anti-Bolshevik. And during that very turbulent period of a couple of years, more and more people were becoming displaced, being driven out of their homes by Trotsky's New Red Army, and fearful for their lives, especially after the Tsar and his family were murdered in July 1918. Then the following day, the Tsaritsa's sister and several Grand Dukes and Princes were murdered not far away. Then in January 1919, four Russian Grand Dukes also were shot. One of them, tragically, he's a major character in my book, Grand Duke Paul, had this beautiful house in Paris, rather foolishly went back to Russia just before the war, and then, of course, got rounded up after the revolution and shot. His wife got out. So there was a huge displacement of people in Russia. They reckon at least 1 million left during that period of revolution and civil war. And Russians went all over the world. I mean, many went to Berlin because that was quickest and easiest to get to. And it was kind of on a crossroads in Europe to getting to other places. Others went to Serbia. Others went to Italy. As such, the first emigres didn't really get to America till a bit later, till they were pretty much driven out of Paris with the onslaught of the war, Second World War and the Nazis. But there was huge movement of people. And for most of the Russians getting out during after the revolution and during the Civil War, a few got out north via Finland, but that route became inaccessible. A few went to the Far East and ended up in Harbin. There was a whole Russian enclave of emigres in Harbin and even in Shanghai. But most of them, they couldn't get out directly west at the time because the war was still raging until 1918. So most of them went south. And so you get this incredible bottleneck where they're forced further and further south to the ports of Novorossiysk and to Odessa. Odessa was another major exit point for many of the Russians fleeing. But a few more, a lot of the White armies, in fact, as they were driven south by the Red Army, ended up bottled up in Crimea and got out from Sevastopol on a whole mishmash of boats, and all kinds of vessels came to the rescue, including French and British vessels. But there was the terrible scenes of chaos with thousands and thousands of people fighting to get on a whole medley of different boats. It's not quite like Dunkirk in that there were lots of little boats, as the Dunkirk rescue was. From Odessa and various places, there were some old naval ships from the Tsarist Navy. There were some Allied ships, the Brits and French then ships, but there were a lot of other sort of merchant ships and tramp steamers, and a whole conglomeration of vessels took these people across the Black Sea to Constantinople. And then by 1920, you have an enormous refugee problem in Constantinople. At one point, well, they reckon thousands and thousands passed through, but maybe 250,000. But certainly there were huge numbers of penniless, destitute, homeless, frightened Russians stranded in Constantinople from 1920 to about 1922, who then had to be helped by the League of Nations for sending people there and various other relief organizations. But it took time for these people to be able to be helped to find new homes elsewhere.
Given these desperate circumstances and this turmoil, people would have ended up in Paris really suddenly without a clear plan of what to do and how they would live. How did they start to build new lives? And what did they feel about the nation they'd been forcibly kind of forced out of, I suppose?
Well, first of all, how did they build new lives? This exactly encapsulates the problem. You've got to imagine many of the aristocrats who landed up there and the officer class, the well-educated people, the men only knew one thing, and that was that they'd known the military life in the White Russian Army. So they could maybe drive a car or drive be chauffeurs or taxi drivers. And the Russian taxi drivers in Paris became legendary. But many of the aristocrats, and one of them said this, Grand Duke Dmitri Pavlovich had sister Maria Pavlovna, who said, well, we just didn't know how to earn a living. These people have lived incredibly privileged lives. They'd never had to lift a finger. They never had to, you know, carry money around with them particularly. So these people suddenly had to support themselves. And the extraordinary thing about the women, and again, this goes back to a catchphrase that was in circulation, was that the men drive taxis and the women sew for a living. Because interestingly, the one thing all these genteel ladies could do was sew, because many of them had been brought up at home with governesses, had been taught to sew and embroider. So many of them actually set up their own fashion houses. And Maria Pavlovna is a case in point. She set up her own fashion house, which she called Kitmir, and she worked there with her in-laws, Prince and Princess Putyatin, and did quite well because through Dmitri Pavlovich, her brother, she met Coco Chanel. And Coco Chanel loved Maria's beautiful Slavic embroidery and the kind of sort of Russian feel of her work, and kind of, you know, signed her up to provide work for her first Slavic-inspired fashion collection in 1922. Others, Prince Felix Yusupov, who with Dmitri Pavlovich had plotted the murder of Rasputin, he and his beautiful wife, Irina, who looked like a mannequin and was very photogenic, they too set up their own fashion house, Irfe, which was Irina and Felix combined, and even brought out a perfume like Chanel did with Number 5, and various other people. There was the House of Berry and various other smaller scale fashion houses. Prince Gavriil Romanov and his wife also had a fashion house. But unfortunately, they all suffered the same fate, which was the downturn economically in the 1930s. But at least the women, and for the most part, many of the women doing the sewing and working in the French fashion industry were probably doing quite menial work in ateliers on sewing machines or doing piecework in their pokey little hotel rooms. But it was the women who kept the men going, because unless the men, well, most of the Russian men were waiting tables or being MCs at posh Russian star restaurants, or driving taxis, or working on the assembly line at Renault. But there are many, many stories, including even in George Orwell's wonderful classic account, Down and Out in Paris and London, where he had a friend called Boris, and they used to tramp the streets of Paris together looking for work, and they both end up washing dishes. And that is not an exaggeration. A lot of Russians, men even, you know, the humiliation they had to suffer, having perhaps come from a very good profession in Russia, being reduced to washing dishes and washing windows and doing the most awful menial jobs.
There's a story about a factory worker from Russia who, I don't know if this is a true story or apocryphal, wearing a tie on the factory line, do we get a sense of how they were regarded by their co-workers, by the people in Paris who were there at the time they arrived?
Well, it's very interesting in terms of the factory workers, the men on the Renault line, that it was said you could always tell the Russian workers because they dressed smartly and wore a tie. And this is where you see the kind of problems of integration rearing their head. The French workers didn't like the Russians. Why? Because the Russians turned up on time. They were never late. They did a job. They took their pay without argument. They did not go on strike because they'd come out of Russia penniless. The last thing they were going to do is risk their jobs. So because the Russians were such good, reliable workers, a lot of the French workers, especially in places like the Renault factory, looked on them as scabs, because they wouldn't strike and they wouldn't be bolshy and fight for more money. But one of the other problems, which was, I think, the second part of the question I wanted to answer, the real problem that does raise its head, is the difference between those Russians who integrated and assimilated and those who didn't. And it's quite a stark contrast. Many of them, of course, the older generation, they didn't learn French. They lived in their little communities of fellow Russian émigrés. They went to their little Russian churches. They cooked their Russian food. And it was really the Russians who really made a go of it in emigration were fundamentally the ones who learned French, maybe even took French citizenship and assimilated. And in general, that didn't happen until the next generation, until their children's generation. But of course, so because of that, because they couldn't bear to give up their sense of Russianness, and because many of them lived in this painful, fading hope of being able to go back home to Russia one day, life in emigration was pretty melancholy and really very hard for a lot of them.
Picking up on that idea then, do we get a sense of how, and this is an impossibly broad question, I know, of how some of these people regarded the Russia they'd left behind? Did they work to restore it or to return there? How did they feel about that side of the story?
Well, fundamentally, their regard for the Russia they'd left was huge nostalgia for the Rodina, the motherland. There's this incredibly melancholy longing to go back to Russia. But of course, in emigration, living in their horrible, cheap, cold, pokey rented rooms in Paris, they nursed this image of old Mother Russia, pre-revolutionary Russia, the Russia they had grown up in. They nursed this image of it where, in fact, the new Soviet Russia was changing very, very dramatically and moving away and getting rid of all the old values. You know, the churches were, you know, under Stalin, of course, later, churches were being blown up, religion was being banned, or, you know, everything, the Tsar had been murdered and all the imperial family had been chased out or killed as well. The old Russia they'd known and loved was vanishing. And so from the distance of Paris, there was this kind of pretty half-hearted attempt by some of the white Russians in exile to go on subversive missions or to subvert the new Soviet state in Russia. And so many of them lived in this false hope that somehow that either communism would just sort of collapse and they'd all be able to go home, or the even fainter hope that the whites in emigration would somehow be able to kind of get their act together, not exactly invade and reclaim Russia, but there were about 40,000 of the old white armies in emigration. There were enough of them all over, scattered all over Europe. But there was this faint hope that if, you know, the Soviet Union collapsed and failed, that the white Russians could then move back in and reclaim Mother Russia, their Mother Russia, and restore, not necessarily the monarchy, but restore the old world they'd once known. So they all lived in this really rather tragic sense of false hope.
And were people in Soviet Russia concerned about this group of people over the water doing these plots and having these hopes of restoring what had gone before.
Well, the trouble was, this is the other awful tragedy. They didn't really know, because once the Soviets were installed, the awful thing for the vast numbers of Russians in Paris and elsewhere, they couldn't get news of home. So anyone coming who recently left Russia, people gathered around and wanted to know all the news of Russia. They, you know, letters weren't coming through, you know, parcels weren't coming through. The lines of communication were lost as the system, the Soviet system, became more and more draconian. And equally, on the other side, the people in Soviet Russia had no idea what was going on with their families in emigration. And so they were really cut off from each other. And it became really very, very sad. Families lost touch.
Were there Russians in Paris who supported the Bolsheviks?
Well, I don't know about that. There were certainly Russians in Paris who were, you know, acting on behalf of the new Soviet state, who infiltrated the white Russian army, ex-army groups, as sort of spies and subversives, and tried to undermine their plotting and planning to try and to stir up trouble in Soviet Russia. And what in fact actually happened, these were basically OGPU activists who infiltrated from Russia. The precursor of the KGB in the 30s, there were two plots which were carried out to kidnap leading white Russian officers who were in, you know, the leading voices in the white Russians in exile. First of all, General Kutyopov, who was kidnapped, and the objective had been to take him back to Moscow and torture him and interrogate him. But he never got that far. I think they overdosed an anaesthetic they used to knock him out and killed him before they even got him on the boat. And then in 1939, they did it again. They came back into Paris and kidnapped General Miller. And he was taken back to Moscow, probably to the Lubyanka, and tortured and eventually killed a year later. So those were a couple of the key moments in the history of the sort of Soviet subversion of the white movement in Paris. But as such, the attempts by the whites in reverse to cause any trouble in Russia were pretty minimal. I think there were a couple of small bomb attacks and not much more. I mean, they just didn't have the power or the connections to infiltrate this great monolithic new Soviet state.
Are there any other case studies or individual stories that highlight themes we've not yet discussed that you'd like to talk about particularly?
The only other thing I would say, really, which is the most poignant part of the story, I guess, is that some Russians in the end were so desperate to go back to Russia that they did go back, with varying consequences. I suppose the best example and the saddest example is the great poet Marina Tsvetaeva, who'd suffered dreadfully in exile. She'd been in Paris for some time, but before that she'd been in Prague. Everywhere she went, she couldn't get work. She scrimped and scraped, earning an absolute pittance, writing little bits here and having a poem there published and the odd bit of a short essay or something. And in the end, against her better judgment, she was persuaded to go back to Soviet Russia in the war, and was stranded in Central Asia because of the war. She was sort of evacuated out there, couldn't get any work, was ended up washing dishes in some ghastly impoverished hovel of a house, and hanged herself. Other writers went back, you know, for their 30 pieces of silver. Alexis Tolstoy, one of the first writers to come out, who went to Berlin, and that didn't work for him, so he came to Paris and was pretty disgruntled that he couldn't make a living in Paris either. Went back to Russia, towed the line, became a big sort of apparatchik writer in the Soviet Union, won prizes left, right and centre. He did fine. You know, if you went back and towed the line, you could be okay. But others just went back to die, really. The only one who made a success of it was a woman called Odoyevtseva, I think it was. She went back and was treated like a hero when she finally returned from Paris in the 80s. And she was celebrated. But as such, it didn't work to go back. The Russia they went back to was not the Russia they had left.
You wrote this book during 2020, and obviously events in Russia since have taken a turn that I don't think anyone could have necessarily expected, the extent of it. Do you think this story has any lessons for us with the Russia of the 21st century?
Well, the thing that struck me most is how that I found actually very interesting, because I have friends in Russia, you know, intellectual friends, artistic, creative people, and they have told me that all the same, exactly the same kind of people are leaving, have left after the war broke out, that left in around 1919-20. The intellectuals, the educated classes, and now it's, of course, the tech whizzes, the IT people, the creative people. They have. I have friends who were working in Russia who are now in Ljubljana, who are in Tel Aviv, back in Zagreb, and went to Armenia. Oh, another one's in Baku. There's this same dispersal of intellectuals and talent and the professional classes that's been prompted by the recent war, as happened then. And it's terribly sad. There is quite an obvious parallel with this kind of brain drain, because the Russians in 1920 and just before, you know, in that exodus that went on after the revolution, they lost the cream of the intelligentsia, of the educated classes. And the same thing, in a way, has happened now.
That was Helen Rappaport. Her book, After the Romanovs, Russian Exiles and Paris Between the Wars, is out now, published by Scribe. And if you're intrigued to find out more about Tsarist Russia, check out the documentary Empire of the Tsars, Romanov Russia with Lucy Worsley, which is available now on BBC iPlayer. Thanks for listening to the History Extra podcast. This podcast was produced by Brittany Colley.